Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll have the real pleasure to welcome back to the podcast Andra Gillespie, who is the author of Race and the Obama Administration, Substance, Symbols, and Hope. The book is published by Manchester University Press, and I have the pleasure to welcome Andra back. Andra, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm great. We were just sort of briefly talking about the fact that you were part of the very early days of this podcast. You were gracious enough back then to share your time about your earlier book. And now we have the chance to have you back. So that's great. And thank you for being kind of like taking the risk at that point in 2012 to come on. And we're still going. And you are as well. Maybe you could just very briefly sort of reintroduce yourself. Where are you now? What have you been doing since you came back on? And then we'll talk about the book.
So I'm a political scientist at Emory University. I study African American politics, and I tend to write books about politicians who try to use racially transcendent tactics and messages to get elected. I'm interested in how voters, particularly Black voters, respond to them. And I'm interested in what they do once they actually get elected to office. There's a lot of normative concern about trying to be racially transcendent to win offices in the wake of there being racial discrimination and inequality in the United States. And in African-American politics, we're really concerned about whether or not African-American politicians are actually best positioned to advocate on behalf of African-American interests. So my first book was about Cory Booker, and I looked at his time as mayor of the city of Newark to look at how Black voters responded to his racially transcendent campaign tactics, and then how he performed during his first term as mayor of Newark. And for the second book, which I'm glad to come back to be able to talk about on this podcast, I focus on President Obama. And so if I had to come up with another subtitle for my book, I would probably be What Obama Did for Black People.
Yeah. The book is so interesting and so timely as we get a little more distance from the Obama administration, are able to as political scientists, make better sense of the entirety of the 8 years of the entirety of that administration. You write at the sort of the start of the book that others have also weighed in on this, and these are some considerable scholars of considerable reputation, and that your work speaks to what they have done, and also contrasts in some ways. I wonder if you could sort of briefly summarize sort of where the early takes were on the Obama legacy, and who were some of the most prominent authors of those takes. What did they make, and how does that sort of reflect your approach in coming to this work?
Well, if I had to identify the sort of strains of the Obama literature, it would be three strains and maybe three different time periods. So the first strain would be the types of books that focused on how Obama got elected. And the questions there are thinking about what role did race play in his election. So thinking about work by Don Kinder and Alison Dale Ritter, If I am thinking about work by Michael Tesler and David Sears, they're looking at how Obama got elected and what's the role of racial resentment in predicting support for or opposition to President Obama. And a lot of those books came out pretty early in 2009 and 2010 because they were focused on electoral politics. Then there were the edited volumes that also came out pretty quickly in the Obama administration, and many of them were kind of foreshadowing what people thought they were going to see in the Obama administration. So there were a couple of big ones. There's Obama Year One, for instance. There was Thomas Crotty's edited volume. I think it's the Obama Presidency. And then there are the books that came out about halfway through President Obama's term in office, and toward the end as well. And so a lot of them are focusing on rhetoric and focusing on whether or not Blacks were getting the bang for their buck, if you will, from having had Obama served as president. So the first books that are coming out in 2011, around 2012, would be Fred Harris's The Price of the Ticket, Michael Dawson's Not in Our Lifetimes, and then more recently thinking about the books that focus on rhetoric. So Michael Eric Dyson's book, Melanie Price's book, The Race Factor, Daniel Gillian's book, which actually takes a more comprehensive view of the entire American presidency and looks at rhetoric, you know, going all the way back, looking at the public papers of the president. So, you know, in many ways, my decision to write this book, and it really did take me about 7 years to write the book, was in part a response to the stuff that came out immediately after President Obama was elected, and especially in some of the edited volumes, a relative dearth of focus on race and how race was important. So we had the scholars in political psychology who were very interested in questions of how racial resentment and animus impacted the Obama presidency. When you started to shift to thinking about, well, the what now, so what aspect of it, there were people who were talking about all aspects of the Obama administration, but weren't always talking about race. And so I knew I wanted to contribute to that conversation. And then as I saw the scholarship emerging that was critiquing President Obama, one of the things that, you know, sort of struck me about it was that there was a lot of focus on rhetoric and that perhaps I could make a contribution to this literature by thinking about not just rhetoric, but also thinking about what we can gather in terms of policy initiatives. And so, you know, there's still more work to do. And so I expect that there are going to be many, many, many more books about the Obama administration, maybe even some that I write. But I wanted to take a first stab at actually looking at things that the Obama administration did and how they were talking about what they did and whether or not that we can use that as a signal about what the Obama administration's priorities were with respect to race.
Yeah, the sort of start of the book, you say that you break up some of your work into four steps and use a variety of methods to come to this other aspect of the Obama years, the Obama administration. One of those that you describe are the substantive policy aspects of the Obama administration. What actually the White House did on these issues. How do you evaluate this part of the Obama legacy? What were the policy decisions, successful and not successful, that were made that relate to race?
Well, I mean, and I'll start off by saying I only scratched the surface. So there is plenty more to write about this. And, you know, I expect that I and others will kind of continue to come back to this. I decided that I'm going to look at four cabinet level departments to look at their press releases and to see how they're talking about race, how they're framing issues. So I'm looking, one, are they talking about race broadly? Are they talking about African-Americans specifically? And then looking at certain types of actions. So I look at the Department of Labor, the Department of Education, the Department of Health and Human Services, and I look at the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division to see what they're talking about. So, you know, this is going to vary across departments because they have different types of purview. So, for instance, the thing that I'm most interested in Health and Human Services is how they're talking about healthcare and, in particular, how it looks for the healthcare rollout. And I compare the Obama administration to the Clinton administration during that same time period. So, as we were talking the 2-year period that we're talking about Obamacare and the Obama administration, and then the roughly 2-year period that we're talking about Hillary Care and the healthcare initiative that President Clinton put her in charge of. And I want to see to the extent to which people are talking about race and whether or not these issues are being framed as a racialized issue. We know now that if we look at health insurance and enrollment rates, that we see the number of people who are uninsured declines across all racial groups. And that's going to be particularly important for Black and Latino Americans. But the gap in terms of rates of uninsured actually doesn't change that much. So it's a very similar thing that we talk about when we talk about lower unemployment rates. And we know that pretty much over time, African-American unemployment is typically about twice the rate of white unemployment. So even in good times like the times that we're in now economically, where we have relatively low unemployment, yeah, unemployment goes down for African-Americans, but the gap has barely narrowed over time. And so there's still an important thing to a question to ask about whether or not we're actually reducing inequality, even if more people are uninsured or have insurance, or even if more people have jobs at this point. So I try to get at that, but so when I'm looking at the Justice Department, I am looking at what types of discrimination are they addressing. So in their press releases, are they dealing with hate crimes? Can I detect the race of the person based on the conversation in the press release? Are they dealing with voting rights? Are they dealing with human trafficking? What kinds of issues are being brought up? And can we and can I sort of code those as being racialized or not racialized? Can I code this as being something that would target African-Americans or not? In the Department of Labor, I'm looking at a particular branch of the Department of Labor where I'm looking at employment discrimination, where I'm looking at the types of industries that are being monitored and actually being sanctioned for illegal behavior. And we can sort of look and see whether or not it's industries that, minorities are disproportionately represented in, who is being discriminated against in terms of employment discrimination cases and the like. And in the Department of Education, I'm looking at their press releases and they're talking about all kinds of initiatives. So whether it's women in STEM issues or My Brother's Keeper, because My Brother's Keeper actually was assigned to the Department of Education, how much are they talking about and engaging race? And so there are a number of things that I can see in some instances, like in HHS and the Department of Labor, I can do some comparisons. It's not a perfect comparison, but I can do some comparisons across administrations. And then in places like the Department of Justice, I can actually see how discussions of racial issues change over time, if at all. So, one of the interesting findings that I see, in my data in the Department of Justice data is that there is a spike in discussions of voting rights issues, usually right before elections. And also there is a spike in discussions of voting rights cases in 2012 in particular that seems to be related to preclearance. And so the Justice Department is announcing that it's waiving preclearance from voting rights oversight in localities in mostly the South that were covered by the Voting Rights Act that had not had a history of voting rights complaints for a decade or more. And this was actually really important because it was just interesting to see this cluster of press releases about these counties across the United States who, were being told by the Justice Department that they no longer had to pre-clear changes to their electoral systems with the Justice Department. And what that looks like, it's evidence of, is that the Justice Department was very quietly trying to relax pre-clearance restrictions because they anticipated that Shelby County versus Holder was going to happen, and they wanted to demonstrate that they had some executive nimbleness in terms of not providing an undue burden to certain localities in terms of making them or requiring them to, submit their changes to their electoral systems to the Voting Rights Act. So that's evidence of activity. I think one can disagree with whether or not that was strategically the smart thing to do. In hindsight, it clearly didn't work. The Supreme Court, ended up, invalidating the criteria that we use to determine who's eligible for preclearance in Shelby County versus Holder. But you can see that they are acting and at least attempting to anticipate certain changes that they might get from the court, because the court had already presaged that they might actually invalidate parts of the Voting Rights Act in a 2009 Supreme Court case. So that was certainly really interesting to see in the data.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that you do in the book is you use this metaphor of the paddling duck. And you use the metaphor to try to understand the perception of what the Obama White House was doing from the reality, from the apparent lack of effort to maybe the deep down hidden hard work. I wonder if you could talk about that. You know, why this metaphor might be useful to think about what President Obama was doing, and how you use executive orders to sort of demonstrate the difference between perception and reality.
Well, so I use the notion of the paddling duck because I think many of us have heard that metaphor that, you know, ducks look cool and calm as they're gliding along the surface of the water, but honestly, beneath the surface, they're paddling furiously. And so I think when people have critiqued the Obama administration for having been more symbol than substance and for not doing enough to address African-American interests, what I want to sort of push the reader to consider is the ways in which the Obama administration may have been acting in the interests of African-Americans, but doing it quietly and behind the scenes and not necessarily providing a lot of fanfare to it. This is also really important because scholars and those who critique deracialization have also been, you know, really critical of the idea that President Obama may have been engaging in what Fred Harris calls wink and nod politics. And so that there's this idea that Black candidates run for office and they intentionally don't talk about race while running for office, or they try as much as possible not to avoid talking about race so that they can put a multiracial electoral coalition together, but that Black voters, who are still going to make up the base of their support, know instinctively that because this candidate is African-American, they are going to like do some stuff when they actually get into office. So it's kind of this unspoken pact between Black candidates and Black voters that I may not talk about race during the campaign, but trust me, I've got your back once I actually get into office. And that notion of the wink and nod has always been called into question by scholars who raise the normative concern about what happens when there are conflicts between Blacks and whites, when you've got to take a side. What do you do in those situations? And we've seen instances in sort of the history of African-American office holding where they've been put in really impossible situations in terms of disputes. So David Dinkins kind of comes to mind in terms of some of the disputes that he had to deal with in terms of the Red Apple boycott or the Crown Heights unrest. So it becomes a question of whether or not he's doing enough beneath the surface. And so when I look at executive orders, and the evidence there is small, but there are some places where we do see the Obama administration attending more to racial issues than Bill Clinton or George W. Bush does, or when we're looking at activities in the cabinet level agencies, I do find some evidence that there is some paddling beneath the surface that we were not always aware of or looking at, you know, in the middle of the Obama administration.
Now, looking at sort of the side of policy is just one way to think about this. You also think and talk and analyze a descriptive representation. And I was particularly interested in some of the data collection and coding you did in Chapter 4, where mm-hmm. you looked at the placement of Black presidential nominees. You compared Bill Clinton, George Bush, and President Obama. What did you find in terms of descriptive representation in this way? You look at all sorts of different appointments, from the well-known cabinet appointments to the often unknown advisory board nominations. A number of things jumped out at me. What struck you about the descriptive representation legacy of the Obama administration, especially as it compares to his predecessors?
Yeah, so there's a lot going on there. And so I should probably just, you know, be really transparent about the methodology here. We looked for as many names as we could find of appointees, and we didn't get them all. We especially didn't get them all for the Clinton administration. And then we took as many names as we could find. And then we looked up biographies just so that we can see, whether or not they talk about themselves in the context of their racial or ethnic identity, and looked for pictures. And we made judgment calls about who, would largely be identified as white and who would be identified as non-white. And then I look at the types of offices for which these candidates were being nominated across time. And so I'm interested in sort of the cabinet level offices, people who would be appointed to ceremonial positions, so some of the advisory committees and boards, and then want to see if there is a difference in terms of, whether or not we see one more African-Americans and other minorities overall being appointed to serve in some capacity in the Obama administration. And then also whether or not we see we see sort of people being placed in more substantive areas. And so, one of the interesting things to think about was that President Obama did garner some criticism for not being more diverse, say, than the Clinton administration was in terms of cabinet level appointees. So, overall, Bush and Clinton and Obama look roughly similar to one another in terms of the amount of diversity that's represented in those top level positions. So the cabinet level positions, and this is actually especially helpful for Obama when you add in the senior level advisors like Valerie Jarrett, for instance. So if we look at cabinet and cabinet level appointees, weren't, especially at the beginning of the Obama administration, a whole lot of African American appointees. So Eric Holder was the one Black cabinet level official who came in with the Obama administration. Over time, he has five African Americans who serve. And then if you add in some of the most senior members of the president's staff, right, that's where you get the diversity. And so that looks different than the Clinton administration. It even looks different from George W. Bush's administration. Overall, President Bush had four African Americans serve in cabinet positions over the course of his presidency. And so there was some critique of that about whether or not his cabinet was diverse, even though he was African-American. I start to look overall at where we see African-American representation. And overall, we do see a higher proportion of his appointees, the ones that I could find, who would be classified as African-American. We see higher numbers of Asian-American representation. Obama has higher levels of Latino representation compared to Bill Clinton, in particular, about the same compared to George W. Bush. He has higher rates of representation for Native Americans in his administration. And then one of the things that's actually really interesting, based on the data that I have, and so acknowledging, again, there maybe people whom I don't have their information for, he in his over the course of his administration did have, especially compared to George W. Bush, and even slightly more so, it's only a difference of about 2 percentage points, maybe had a slightly higher number of judicial nominations compared to Bill Clinton in the first 2 years of office, and had a higher proportion of diplomatic nominations compared to Bill Clinton. It's a little bit lower than George W. Bush in his first 2 years of office. One of the things that, I do point out, and so you could use this as a sign of symbolic representation, is there are a lot of African Americans. So in the first 2 years, about a quarter of his nominees to advisory boards were African American. And that's a higher proportion than I could find in the data for Clinton and Bush, even though I acknowledge the limitations of my data there. And actually, he nominated more people to do work that could easily be classified as being of interest to African Americans. So, for instance, nominating people to serve on advisory boards for historically Black colleges and universities, for instance, or anything that might actually be targeted towards trying to address racial inequality or reduce gaps. So some people could argue that some of those positions were symbolic because they were just making recommendations to the administration. But it's important to see that Blacks were actually being included in the administration in ways that, you know, were different from the previous two administrations.
Yeah, the book, the really interesting book, is again titled Race and the Obama Administration, Substance, Symbols, and Hope. Andra's book is published by Manchester University Press. Andra, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.